This is Sierra Dolan with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and our discussion today is talking about alternate revenue models for utilities. And we have Bob Perry of Synergistic Solutions and Jerry Braun at Integrated Resources Network. Which one of you two want to start first? Jerry or Bob?
Either way is fine with me. I'll tell you what I've got to offer, and Bob and I talked yesterday.
So Jerry, you're going to go ahead then. Yeah, go ahead and start.
Well, no, not necessarily.
No, that's fine. Go ahead, and you can be the first one. Let's do that.
Bob, is that okay with you?
That's fine.
Because I was kind of expecting Bob to go first, but
I could offer a couple of opening thoughts, which I think might lead into your paper,
Bob.
Which I think,
Go ahead, you're on.
So,
you can go first.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, revenue models or alternative revenue models, you know, I think about, you know, what's the primary objective here? And, you know, the obvious answer is it's to incentivize certain behavior. It's to get people to do things in a certain way to achieve a certain result. And I think that, you know, what we're dealing with at present is we're facing a need to make fundamental structural change to how our energy system functions and who participates and who benefits. And we need to develop a model that incentivizes that kind of change. And Jerry shared a paper with me, which I sent a link to, which I think really kind of lays out, you know, fundamental issues and objectives that need to be, that we need to move towards. And the question is, okay, how can we incentivize that behavior? So, you know, that's kind of my opening statement. And if, Jerry, if you want to kind of go into, to, you know, what you've written and what you see to be the strategies that we need to obtain that result. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that sounds fine. Thank you very much for sending the material out in advance, because I think it really helps. And I really appreciate what Bob's kind of a message, which is, we got to find, and I put it a little bit different way. We've got to find workarounds. Time is of the essence. Waiting for, new legislation and structures that will come is not, the only thing we can do. We do have the option to try some things that are possible, and then hope that they can be institutionalized if they work, and assuming they do work. And what I thought I would do, I mentioned one of the items in the paper that Bob mentioned, but I just kind of made a list of what I, kind of the workarounds that I just mentioned, and I like different models, and I just wanted to kind of go through them just to kind of stimulate discussion, but I think the models that we need to revenue models and other that we need to think about, there's some basic pragmatic principles that we need to understand up front. Number one, transporting energy isn't a natural monopoly anymore. You can generate energy locally cheaper than you can import it from somewhere else, and that's a big change. There's no time to create new market structures for energy transport. The infrastructure is there. It's working. We need to use what's there. And then finally, and we've talked about this many, many times in this forum, you know, the local governments, there are gaps that local governments are going to have to fill. And part of the reason is they're publicly accountable. So just maybe a minute or two, there's some background noise somewhere.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Jerry, we've got some background noise going on, so please make sure you're muting your phone. Otherwise, I'll have to mute the entire group. So go ahead and check that out.
Okay.
Right, go ahead, Jerry. Yeah, sorry.
So five pragmatic strategies. Some of them are being implemented. Some of them are just possibilities. And I've given them names: the trash collection model, pay-to-play model, micro-municipalization model, local menus model, and start from scratch model. So the trash model, basically trash collection, waste collection in cities and counties, basically is outsourced by the city. But they collect the revenues to pay for it, and then they outsource the actual service. And I got to wondering if it wouldn't be possible for that kind of a relationship to exist in the energy sector, where nothing changes except that the revenues flow first to the city, then to the incumbent energy service provider, but that would expand the scope of the utility franchise agreements.
Okay, Jerry, I'm going to mute the group here, and I'll unmute you. Here, we got way too much noise going on here, so hang on. Sorry about that. I thought it would work, but it's not. So.
Okay. All right, and so. Okay, is that okay?
Hang on. Here you are. You should be okay now.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. You're good.
Okay. So, so what if instead of utilities negotiate franchise agreements with the cities where they provide service, and typically it's just to compensate the cities for the extra costs that they incur in having the things that the utility has to do done. But what if the agreement were more of a similar to waste collection, where not only there's a kind of compensation kind of thing, but fundamentally there's a contract that the energy service local, that the utility, gas or electric, basically agrees to provide service according to certain terms and standards and policy guidelines that the city sets. I won't go into any details on this. We can discuss it further. The pay-to-play model is more has a more of a collaborative approach between the city and the utility. The utility continues to collect distribution charges as part of their, cost buildup. And they do it now according to, usage. But that doesn't need to change for customers, utility customers that are not self-generating. But what could change is that the self-generators, those who are net self-generators, could pay just distribution charges, but both ways, charges for power that feeds into the grid and power that comes out of the grid, and then any transmission costs that are directly, that are indexed and directly related to net usage, not total usage. And that's a little complicated. But what that would do would be to allow, that would allow, the city to provide virtual net metering services to, customers who can't, can't have solar on their roof or what have you, for renters in particular, and also for community scale renewable and storage projects. Okay, the next model is what I call micro-municipalization, and it's something, there's been an announcement recently, some of you may have seen, a city in California, Gonzales, is basically municipalizing an industrial area in order to build a microgrid. And in this model, the city will essentially purchase the distribution assets in the area. They will upgrade the generation and, have a combination of mostly renewable but part natural gas generation, so for resiliency purposes. And they will contract with the current energy service provider to upgrade the assets that so that you can have a functioning microgrid. And the cost of service will be less than or equal to the cost of current service. So I'm sorry. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. You're fine. Go ahead. I muted everybody and unmuted you, so go ahead.
Okay. So let's go on to the, let's finish up the models. I mentioned something. Called the local menus model, and basically California utilities and mostly in other states as well offer a menu of customer-facing programs, and they administer their delivery of the programs. They recover the costs plus a fee indexed to program expenditures. What if cities and counties were able to propose a portion of the menu of existing programs or competitive program designs that would cost less to implement locally and or have greater impact and receive compensation from the incumbent utility in the amount of program revenues, program implementation revenues it's entitled to collect. This is kind of the trash model with the roles reversed. But it also provides a pathway to mutually beneficial collaboration. And finally, the start from scratch community renewables model. There is a city happening and being developed, 20,000 population city in Florida, where the developer has said, I want this to be net zero. And the incumbent utility said, okay, we will build and pay for and operate a 150 megawatt solar electricity project to meet the eventual usage. After build out, we'll add storage and in effect provide provide the supply to make the city, the new city, net zero, and provide, of course, the electricity distribution infrastructure with at the same rates for that city as everybody else in their service territory. So I just wanted to end with the thought that I think we need to think about workarounds, because time is not on our side. We're facing a situation where state governments, national governments are going to be totally distracted and disrupted because of some things that are happening that we all know about. And it's not going to be, it's going to be a real slow process to drive things forward in terms of change from the top down. And so hopefully that'll happen, but we also need, you know, some sorts of workarounds where we can move things forward a little bit faster from the bottom up. So that's my thought.
All right.
Bob, do you have a comment? No, I don't know. Go ahead, Sierra.
Yeah, I'm unmuting you. You're good. Oops, did you re-mute yourself here? We're having a little technical problems on my end. Are you okay, Bob? Okay, you're good.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, I'm good.
All right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think Jerry and I, you know, we're thinking along the same lines. I'm kind of approaching it from the opposite end. And, you know, I'm involved in a lot of the regulatory proceedings that are going on in California and encountering, you know, a lot of kind of down in the weeds, what would be thought of as pragmatic approaches towards dealing with something, but it really kind of loses sight of the larger objective, which needs to be acknowledged and acted upon, is that, you know, we're moving to a whole different type of system. You know, right now our revenue models are all based on the old system, which is, centralized generation, near 100% use of transmission distribution infrastructure, and that creates, you know, this whole rate case model that the utilities present to the Utilities Commission. I'm speaking in California now, and it's all based upon, you know, universal use of the entire system, because that's the way it was. Well, it's not that way anymore. And so really, you know, one of the primary objectives that I see that a revenue model has to achieve is leveling up the playing field. And that's going to require integration of delivery costs into the price of energy. You know, right now we all pay for the transmission infrastructure on whatever energy we produce, whether it or not it uses the transmission system. And that this, you know, tilts the playing field against distributed energy development, because it adds costs, superfluous costs to projects. And so, you know, we need to look back and say, okay, we need to have a level playing field where you only pay for the infrastructure that you use. And if you're not moving in that direction, then you're not really going to enable the kind of development that is needed to get you where you want to go. And that's going to require a lot of change, and I understand the urgency to the situations, but I would posit that trying to get through, implement that change through regulatory agencies is going to take a lot longer than coming from a top-down approach and recognizing, you know, the larger objectives and putting pressure both from above and below on the utilities companies, the utilities and the Utilities Commission to do the structural changes needed and to assign a point importance to that. One thing that is also needed is that we need to look beyond just, you know, the immediate sphere of stationary energy and look for solutions that address multiple issues and objectives. One example is, you know, California's need to reduce transportation emissions. So to the extent possible, if you're looking towards electrification of the transportation sector, then you have to consider, you know, the dynamics of that transition in whatever you plan in the stationary sector as well. So the revenue model needs to change to where we're not incentivizing utilities to develop utility-centric solutions that involve development of just broad infrastructure. It needs to incentivize utilities to develop the kind of solutions that builds resiliency, energy resiliency, which is inherently local, and also to develop, to incentivize private investment, because, you know, we're in this economic recession. It's going to get worse. Public money is very scarce. And so my measure of success for the utilities is how well they're able to incentivize private investment, i.e. commercializing many of these technologies. And this was really became apparent in the microgrid commercialization proceeding in California that I've been involved with. You know, they've started out, their solutions are very utility-centric, and they're very slow to really get at the heart of the problem, which is how do we commercialize microgrid development? And that involves making things easier for businesses and other participants to be part of the solution. So I would say, you know, the revenue model should be gauged on, you know, how many different stakeholders you can bring into the process, and how that can incentivize and accelerate development of these types of energy systems.
Okay, so, we're going to go ahead and bring in a few other people for questions, Q&A here. And also, I have a couple people who are, one of whom is 626-232-7573. Who is that? And I'll unmute your line so you can answer. I think I've unmuted it. Maybe I didn't. Yep. Who's on that line? 626-232-7573. Identify yourself, please.
Yeah, hi. My name is Ben Schwartz. I work with the Clean Coalition.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Just checking. And then we have one other person here that I don't know who that is. 845-430-8851.
Yeah, it's Ron.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Ron. I don't know why I didn't have your number there. All right. Well, very good. Is that Ron Kamen?
No, the other one, Leonard.
Leonard. Okay, super. All right. All right, super. We'll go ahead and open this up to Q&A. Unless, Jerry, do you want to comment on some things that Bob said? Do you want to start out with that? I will unmute everybody, but please mute your own phones so that we don't hear a lot of noise.
Sarah, I would like to comment on Bob's comments, because I totally agree. And Bob is, I can add a couple of things that are in the paper that Bob mentioned that I think really reinforce, Bob's concerns that, you know, you doing the kinds of things locally, like developing microgrids and so forth, you have to have affordable supply. And right now, it is affordable, except that, as Bob mentioned, there's an overlay of charges on the local supply that makes it uneconomic. You know, and to be very specific, the costs of solar electricity have really plummeted to the point that literally the costs of large-scale projects like the one I mentioned are in the range of a couple cents per kilowatt hour. Meanwhile, the added cost that is not justifiable technically, is part of current regulation, rate regulation, is twice that. So you can see that something that is fundamentally economical and doesn't cost money to deliver other than via the local infrastructure is being penalized to the point of being not feasible by rules that are totally out of date related to, you know, in the context of what has happened to cost. Transmission costs have gone way up in California. Solar costs have come way down. And the most important thing is that the difference between centralized production costs and local production costs is now much less than the overlay cost of transmission services that are really not there. You know, no, don't get me wrong, the transmission system needs to be maintained and it needs to be paid for. I'm not suggesting otherwise, but those costs need to be apportioned according to transmission system usage, not just everybody has to pay the same cost no matter what they're doing. So that's a little bit long introduction, but I really wanted to reinforce what Bob said.
All right. Any other comments here? Just go ahead and dive in.
Well, this is Bob again. I just want to totally support what Jerry just said, and the fact is that really what we're trying to do is we're not trying to say, oh, it's distributed energy over transmitted energy. It's saying, you know, if we're really going to electrify major sectors of our energy, our system is going to really grow. And the question is how do we pay for it? And how do we pay for it in a way that is just and equitable? And it just seems to me that if you incorporate delivery cost into the price, then the market will find the right use. And there will be a demand. There's going to be demand for energy that's distributed, you know, that's generated locally, that's highly resilient, that you know, will power our critical functions in the community. And there's also going to be great demand for energy from out of state or from various parts of the state to be able to decarbonize transportation, heavy industry, all these different sectors. And so the key is you know, how do we incentivize a payment system that is just and equitable? So that's my comment.
Any thoughts on this? A lot of people involved. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, hi.
This
I'll
is
jump in. Oh. Go ahead, Adam.
This is Evan Hughes. Are you saying that the transmission charges should be based only on the kilowatt hours that you buy from the grid and not based on just being connected to the grid? In which case, if you're using solar for most of what you do, your transmission charges are only on the, you know, 10% or so you actually buy from the grid. Is the problem that these transmission charges are paid for as on a connection basis rather than on an actual use basis?
That's the problem.
And
yeah,
the PUC.
Yes.
Hi guys. This is Ron.
Yeah.
Here's Donna, based on two extreme utilities. The first utility being New York, which I have some experience in, since we put in, you know, a gigawatt worth of power plants in New York over the years. The utilities in New York are old and also new. The old utilities like Con Ed have a built-in resistance to change that has been overcome. But the new utilities like Fortis, like National Grid, like Iberdrola, have another problem, which is that they're foreign controlled and have really no tie to the local structure and interests in the community. So there is a disconnect in terms of need and community need and utility control. The only solution that New York and other places like California has come up with is to have a community choice aggregation instead of a utility being the entity in charge. And the other utility I would love to bring up is Puerto Rico, which is one of the oldest and I guess still probably fairly large as a muni, and it is one of the most corrupt and inept utilities that is associated with the U.S., and its problem really has been mismanagement, but also the same issue that New York has and probably all other utilities have, which is there is a complete disconnect between the need of Puerto Rico, that is the ratepayer, and the utility. The need of the ratepayer in Puerto Rico is not only clean energy, but to pay down a $9 billion debt that the utility has brought up, and they're paying $2 billion a year in importing fossil fuels, so they'll never get out of the debt. Thus, you know, some other entity has been brought in, a Canadian company, to oversee this existing utility, which should have been there and should have been managed correctly. So what I'm pointing out is that functionally, utilities are in themselves the problem. And what we really should be concentrating on is another model, either a CCA or some other entity that really, in effect, represents the ratepayer.
Any comments?
You'll get no argument from me on that. And when I say, you know, revenue models, I'm not specifically talking about the utilities. I mean, right now it is the utilities just because that's the way it's been. But I think, you know, one critical element is community empowerment. And the issue of energy resilience has raised this problem because it's becoming a fact, or it is a fact, that the farther you have your generation source is from the point of consumption, the less resilient it is. And I want to give a shout out to Clean Coalition. Ben Schwartz is on the call. You know, they've really been focusing on that. They've been doing a lot of work on the transmission access charge issue, and then also doing a lot of work on trying to define, you know, the value of resiliency and where it's most needed. And, you know, these types of concepts and frameworks really need to be at the forefront of the conversations. And this is the problem, is that it's not with the utilities right now, which really begs the question, is we really need to come in over the utilities through the governor's office, the legislature, and also from communities to really, you know, put pressure on the utility commission to make fundamental change and to make energy policy more community centric. And it's happening in California to a degree and in New York and these other places.
Yeah, this is Jerry. I agree with that. And I also think that we need to kind of squeeze from both the bottom and the top. When things start happening that are, you know, that that the utilities haven't planned for and they need to react, that's good because that kind of stimulates thinking. And so the more we can do that just kinds of changes as much as possible that opens up opportunities for local control and local supply. Those are the kinds of things that will, you know, kind of reinforce the need for the kind of change Bob is talking about.
Anybody?
Bob and Jerry, this is Richard Chase. One of the things that I've observed, I'm a commissioner of a small muni in Massachusetts, and we are fed by National Grid in terms of supplier, and we're doing quite a bit with our system in terms of maintenance, and tree trimming, et cetera, which is the basic blocking and tackling of the business. We're not seeing that same level of effort by the investor-owned utilities. And I'm wondering, you know, in terms of making profit, it's more profitable if you defer the maintenance. The problem is that eventually it catches up with you.
Yeah. We see that in the other utility services that cities provide as well. You know, deferring costs is what causes the eventual big costs, and yet it's a natural thing to do if you're trying to keep rates stable and as low as possible. So there is kind of a community dynamic that has to be dealt with too. That it's not, you know, we have challenges at all levels of government, basically.
Agreed.
So this is Baird Brown. I've been, on behalf of Microgrid Resources Coalition, also active in the current proceedings before the PUC. And we certainly have recalcitrant utilities, although that's not different than every place else I've dealt with. And we have, also not different, a recalcitrant utility commission who's mostly about defending the status quo. I have fantasies about some of the experiments that we've heard described, but I think that I'm with the first commenter who said that leveling the playing field and just letting localities and the industry, you know, start to do what it will pay them to do without interference is the biggest single thing. And when it starts to happen, then there will be change in the regulatory scheme, and it will follow what's happening on the ground because it will have to. I think it's great to have models ready, and there are other models that haven't been mentioned in California, but which the PUC seems to be entertaining. I mean, one which is tried and true back from 2000-2001 is forming little local co-ops that are basically allowed to do whatever they want, including crossing streets and things like that. And, you know, then there's this mini utility provision, which the staff has also pointed to, which they apparently would entertain. I guess we'll wait and see if the commission will really entertain it, but at least the co-op model is there and ready for the taking if people want it. It was used by industrial groups before, mostly. The big problem right now are basically 218 of the Public Utility Code, but 218 is bad enough, but the utilities have their own rules that limit the ability to provide power to second or third customers even more so, and prevent resale of power that's imported by a microgrid or a local entity of whatever sort, whether that's a community or a private set of customers. And that's a huge impediment. And the departing load charges, which are, you know, were originally brought in to foster retail competition, and then that experiment was abandoned, but then the departing load charge was adapted to paying off the debts of the water board to, you know, for buying power during the crisis. And when that was all paid off, they readapted it for some other reason, which they can't really explain, as part of the revenue model of the utilities. And so it's just backwards. It's sort of, you know, penalizing the people who want to pay to bring the capacity that's needed, both for the transportation electrification and for the local resilience and for the fact that we're running out of capacity in general and are having brownouts in California. So, I think the more we can lean on just getting an open playing field to the, you know, for all the innovative people out there, whether they're communities or individual customers or groups of customers, and the industry that's willing to help them out, you know, then all the changes will come because the utilities will have to adapt.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I want to laud Baird and the work he's done with Microgrid Resources Coalition. I mean, they've really been the tip of the spear in this microgrid proceeding, you know, kind of really challenging a lot of these antiquated approaches that has been taken to date. And, you know, one other thing I want to kind of in Baird kind of raised that is, you know, what will happen? What are the consequences of not doing anything or not moving fast enough? And the consequences is that the market will start finding their own solutions, and it may not align with what the utility wants. You know, they had this there's a sub proceeding in the microgrid about alternatives to diesel backup generation, you know, what the solutions are there. And in ARC, I assisted in the comments of Vote Solar and the Climate Center. And in looking at it, colleague had raised what's happening at the Vehicle Grid Integration Working Group and what they've done. And they just recently released this report on June 30th, which shows incredible promise for vehicle-to-grid technology in the area of backup resilience. I mean, EV vehicles, both battery and fuel cells, have tremendous storage capacity. And if you can use that in combination with the grid, establish, you know, standardized interconnections and stuff, you can go a long way to increasing storage capacity. Now, you know, what blew me away when I first read this report was the fact that here we have a multi-agency report. We have the public utilities as one of the sponsoring agencies for this working group. And yet the staff for the microgrid commercialization proceeding, from what I could tell, has no awareness of what's going on over there. And it didn't even begin to consider what the possibilities were and utilizing that. And so, I mean, there's a failure to kind of step back, look at the broader issues, see the general trends politically. And, you know, we have the executive order that Governor Newsom just released regarding eliminating in-state sales of internal combustion engines. We've got the advanced clean truck ruling from the Air Resources Board. You know, you got to take stock of all these trends and start seeing where this is all leading. And this is another real big problem that, I find really frustrating.
Can I interject something? I think Baird and Bob, you know, both have kind of used the tip of the spear metaphor, which I
think is really appropriate. Some of us once thought that community choice would be the tip of the spear, to really be the change agent that tried out some of the things that, you know, the big for-profit utilities, you know, just have no incentive to try out and so forth. But we have this situation that Baird referred to, you know, that, you know, the exit fees are essentially a policy tool to keep the incumbent utilities afloat financially. And that's really what's happening. And as a result, you know, the ability we have invested so heavily from a policy and every other perspective to get these community choice agencies stood up, ready to go, and now all they can do is to turn the crank on the model that the power procurement model that the incumbent utilities were using. They don't have the any flexibility financially to speak of, to deliver local programs, to design them, to intervene in terms of local projects and find ways to get them across the finish line. So we really have a policy tool that we thought would work that really needs to have some attention to what is it going to take to, you know, to allow it to be the change agent that we once thought it could be.
Interesting thought. Go ahead. Anybody comments?
Larissa.
Well, if somebody has not had a chance yet to speak, but they want to start out, anybody here?
Larissa, can you hear me?
Yeah, we're good. Go ahead, Larissa.
Because I didn't know if he still had that 4-star or whatever.
No, we're good.
A couple
here.
Reactions. Join the rest in terms of the need for change. But I guess in the utility, I'm very involved in these regulatory proceedings as well. And in the typical jurisdiction, I mean, a lot of you talking about the more progressive ones, but in the typical, like I've done a lot of work recently in the D.C., you know, they've got stiff mandates, but they never talk barriers. They never talk changing the incentives. And I think, in my view, you can't have level playing field until you change the incentives within the legacy system, and that's the hardest going thing here because of the utility resistance. But you've got, of course, embedded in here the current incentives that steer the rewards to capital intensive investments, and so you don't have equal treatment of the capital with the operational expenses and the way in which they pursue their rates of return. As was mentioned, it gives them less interest in efficiency, less interest in maintenance, and they are continuing to perpetuate this. So I think, you know, what New York Rev has, I don't know how successful it's been recently once Audrey Zibelman left, but getting these incentives changed, I think, is vital. And I think that, you know, more will begin to show. It's already, you know, hitting the decks in D.C. and elsewhere because of the nature of the mandates. I mean, the mandates are becoming more stringent. So if these incentives aren't changed, this is going to lead inevitably to higher costs. But, you know, do we want to wait till that, you know, actually hits the wall? No. And yet there really is a problem with the commissions and their staff. They don't want to talk barriers. They don't want to talk change the incentive. And they cling, of course, to ending or allowing the utility to initiate instead of opening up proceedings that are transparent and allow a lot of stakeholders who now have bigger interests because of the need to use distributed resources in them. But again, if we don't change the incentives and find a way to provide recognition and return to the operational side of expenditures and efficiencies, we won't be steering things in the right direction. That really has to be attended to, and that is moving, I think, exceedingly slowly.
Anybody else who has not had a chance to speak yet?
Yeah, Ben Schwartz from the Clean Coalition here.
Yeah, sure, go ahead, Ben.
I just wanted to echo what Bob was saying about transmission charges and thank him and the panelists for speaking and Jerry for speaking on it. I wanted to ask a question. FERC order 2222 just came out in July, and I wanted to see what everyone thought about the potential of aggregation, behind-the-meter aggregation, playing in wholesale markets, and how big of a change that's going to be for California markets.
You know, Ben, I think that sounds like a whole conversation by itself. Unless people want to respond to that. No, that sounds like an excellent topic for a conference call, unless somebody wants to just explore it briefly here, but that sounds very important.
If I can comment, this is Baird.
Go ahead.
I think it absolutely can be a game changer. It means, for example, that all the pieces of a microgrid can be treated as an aggregation. You know, it's storage, it's generation, it's it's demand response capabilities, and all that can be sold into the ISO market, even if the utilities won't buy it. So I think it doesn't do away with first of all, it's a 3-year process to get it actually up and running. So, you know, but watch this space, and it doesn't get rid of departing load charges, you know, by itself. But I think it's interesting that Utility Commission actually has gone in to FERC and protested PG&E's transmission filing and cited to Order 2222 as being, you know, as that PG&E's strategy on transmission is contrary to Order 2222. So, the commission is in its own silos, but they're, you know, I think it has great promise.
I do as well, of course. I think great potential, but pertinent to the discussion today, you see a big contrast. At least FERC, repeatedly, since the energy storage order, what it has done on the 2222 with respect to the DER aggregation, they are facing barriers to progress, and coming out definitively to evaluate, well, we have new resources here. We should really bring these resources into the market to be able to have competition and bring down the cost. But the thing is, how can you bring them in when you've got participation model designs that are tailored to the physical and operational characteristics of fossil fuels? So they have at least faced head-on the barriers, and they're reworking the incentives, which is in big contrast to the state level. And the other part about this that will be interesting is with these orders, they are putting increasing pressure on for change at the state level. And as part of the Order 2222, they have a whole kind of opening and invitation to the not only the utility distribution companies, but now the regulators themselves. Hey, putting out for you a coordination harmonization framework. You want to join up now, and instead of always litigating against us, FERC, you want to join us and have, find a way that we have in the Federal Power Act, a means for coordination and cooperation with you. Why don't we work together on trying to bring these barriers down and create the level playing field? So it's going to be interesting to see what the states do. So far, big litigation, and even through NARUC, but the problem is they continue to lose. But at least FERC is facing the barriers and trying to eliminate or minimize them and create the level playing field, whereas the states are too... hooked at the hip to the utilities and are moving too slowly.
True.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that order 2222 offers a point of leverage. It opens the door by a crack, and it's evidence of potential alignment between, you know, a federal agency all the way down to the local community. And, you know, the big effort going forward is to try to bend all these different interests into alignment. And so, as was referenced earlier, you know, we use that as a point of leverage and reference in moving our objectives forward.
Anybody else?
This is Evan Hughes. How about having the state buy the transmission system and therefore no longer having to be paid for at the point of use by the customers, but I guess we would pay for it by paying off the bonds that the state has to issue to buy the transmission system, but it would make the prices at the customer side be the right way to encourage more solar, et cetera.
I think that's very possible.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea. You still need to hire somebody periodically to run it. But one of the big problems we haven't talked about much here is how do you get the incentives right so that the balance between local power sources and distant power sources that require transmission gets struck in the right place. And right now, nobody has the incentive to do that.
I would say that that idea, Evan's idea, also applies at the local level. You know, the what we're doing in a lot of cases is financing local supply and infrastructure at prices that are based on you know, the return on investment even higher than is expected by investor-owned utilities, whereas cities and counties do have bonding authority and the ability to selectively, and I'm not suggesting that it's possible to do this across the board, but selectively for particular projects to actually take ownership and finance the projects with lower cost money.
And that is a topic for another call.
Yes, I'm already on that. Definitely. Well, we're almost out of time here, so we can take one more comment, and then I have a couple things to say before we go.
Yeah, this is Ron. I wanted to comment quickly on New York and the REV proceedings that we've been through for the last 6 years, which I consider failed. And one of the things that did happen in the last few weeks, which is a lot of NGOs negotiated with New York State to basically close down all the peaker plants. Now, that is a key to maybe a fundamental change in the state, because if you look at the incentive we keep talking about, the incentive has been for peaker plants like Danskimer, a plant in New York that was transferred over from coal to natural gas, to operate and only for a few hours take $21 million in payments. That same money could be redirected to renewable energy and reduce the debt of all ratepayers. So there can be a fundamental change, but utilities are really fundamentally there to kick the can down the road, and they can't be in charge of that change process.
I think that's, I echo that. I think that's very interesting what's going on, and they've already demonstrated how you can substitute for these peaker plants and function quite reliably. So that's, I think that's going to be a very interesting, you know, what happens there, how that evolves. And it looks like they got some serious support for their trying to substitute and remove these peaker plants.
And the science is there. Dr. Richard Perez, a fundamental revolutionary person who's been in the industry for 40 years, has done independent work with science peer-reviewed work on having 100% renewable energy as baseload power.
I think that's another good basis for a discussion, another call, another time. It's very interesting, in my opinion, and I think it has good prospects.
All right, guys, it looks like we're out of time. All right, so in view of all of this, next month we're going to have Lynn Arthur talking about the content of her webinar, which is on Thursday, a very important process that she's put together for incentivizing citizens to be interested in renewable energy, and not only just renewable energy, but changes of that nature. Worth listening to and also worth probably being a part of that conversation next month. Tomorrow we have a call. It's also going to be interesting. Is renewable gas a real thing, or is it just industry PR? And Myra Moss from Ohio State University is bringing in an expert who's involved with that. She's deep into fracking over there. She's at the Extension Office, and it should be an interesting conversation. Shalom Flank will be leading the discussion. So, hope to see you all tomorrow, and hope to see you on the webinar on Thursday, and thanks for a great conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the conversation.